Yeah, the U.S. negotiations, we really have to look at how to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, and we have to use the existing treaties.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two of our discussion posted online at democracynow.org. Beatrice Finn, executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. She accepted the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the organization. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock, and the KBOO Evening News is next.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater called KBOO at the Clinton. This month, on Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m., we'll celebrate Dia de los Muertos. Muertos Film and Music Night will highlight some of the Dia de los Muertos traditions of Mexico, Central and South America. We'll screen authentic Day of the Dead short films and feature live performances by Virginia Lopez, Mariachi Portland, and more. Again, that's a film celebration of Dia de los Muertos, Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the race between incumbent Oregon Governor Kate Brown and Newt Bueller remains close ahead of a televised debate later tonight.
United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, has announced her resignation.
And in international news, a referendum in Romania to ban same-sex marriage has failed. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 9th, 2018. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Oregon voters can tune in tonight to the debate between Democratic incumbent Governor Kate Brown and Republican lawmaker Newt Bueller. The debate will air at 7 p.m. on KGW Channel 8 and will also be live-streamed on KGW.com as well as their Facebook and Twitter pages. A poll conducted between September 24th and October 7th by the Riley Research Associates for KGW Media Group and The Oregonian shows that Brown has a slight lead at 49% over Bueller's 45%. The poll was answered by 400 people, although a larger sample size was requested. The poll found that 60% of Oregonians have an unfavorable view of President Trump, while 40% view him favorably. The poll also showed that Brown has strong support from the Portland metropolitan area, while Bueller is significantly preferred in Central Oregon. KBOO would like to remind listeners that the 16th is the last day to register to vote in Oregon. You can register to vote in person at your local county elections office or online with a valid Oregon ID card at sos.oregon.gov/voting.
United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, has announced her resignation. She will be leaving the post at the end of the year. Haley announced her departure in the Oval Office with Donald Trump, which came as a surprise to the State Department and the UN Security Council. She is seen as a high-ranking member within the administration, although she has been at odds with Trump on issues like Russian election interference. Before being appointed to this post in 2016, Haley was first female governor of South Carolina. Haley is seen as many as a potential future presidential candidate for the Republican Party. However, in a resignation letter, she stated that she would not run in 2020 and would support Trump's re-election bid. The successor to the position will be named in the next few weeks. Among the names being considered to replace Haley are former National Security Advisor Dina Powell, U.S. Ambassador to Germany Richard Grenell, as well as the president's own daughter, Ivanka Trump.
A referendum in Romania to constitutionally ban same-sex marriage has failed. The president of the pro-referendum group Coalition for Family, Mihai Gheorghiu, said they were trying to, quote, protect at a constitutional level the definition of marriage between one woman and one man. The campaign against the referendum asked the public to boycott the vote in hopes that turnout would fall below the necessary threshold. Only 20.4% of eligible voters cast ballots, while 30% turnout is needed to validate the referendum. This occurred despite the support of the Orthodox Church and the rare step by the government to extend the vote to 2 days rather than one. The failed referendum means the Constitution will retain its current, neutral wording that a family is, quote, founded on the freely consented marriage of the spouses. However, Romania still does not officially recognize same-sex marriage or civil unions. Vlad Visky, president of LGBTQIA rights organization Mosaic, is now calling for the legalization of same-sex civil partnerships because of the failed vote. Last month, Romania's constitutional court ruled that same-sex couples should be given equal rights. In June, the European Court of Justice ruled in favor of a Romanian man, Adrian Coman, whose American husband was denied a spousal visa in Romania after they married in Belgium. Opponents of the referendum argue that it was designed to distract the public from ongoing corruption scandals in the ruling party and instead rally conservative support around the administration.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture. On this episode, satellite voting offices open in one Montana reservation, a Native group vows to fight for child welfare protections, and Indigenous Peoples Day events were held across the country.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Early voting for the November midterm elections opens today in Montana. Voting is expected to be easier for those who live on one reservation with satellite election offices. Yellowstone Public Radio's Jackie Yamanaka explains.
The satellite offices are the result of a successful lawsuit against the state of Montana. The plaintiffs had argued reservation residents face greater hardships to in-person voter registration and voting because of the long traveling distances they face. Mark Wandering Medicine of Bernie was the lead plaintiff in that lawsuit.
I'm from the smallest and isolated community on Northern Cheyenne Reservation. We don't even have no store or nothing. And we had to travel all the way to Forsyth.
Or nearly 87 miles away. He says it could be an even longer trip in inclement weather, and many on the reservation already have a hard time with transportation. A settlement reached in 2014 was to open satellite election offices on the reservations. Then Montana Secretary of State Linda McCullough ordered counties to provide those satellite offices to ensure compliance with the Federal Voting Rights Act and ensure Native Americans can effectively participate in the electoral process.
Indian vote is to be reckoned with.
State Representative Sharon Stewart Paragoy of Crow Agency.
We are a block vote. We are a swing vote, and that we need to take that seriously. We need to understand that. We need to educate our young people that in order to affect change, we have to make that change ourselves.
Stewart Paragoy says there are many issues facing the reservations, and the way to affect change is to vote. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka.
Tribes and Native organizations across the country are vowing to fight for protections under the Indian Child Welfare Act after the Federal District Court for the Northern District of Texas ruled the law unconstitutional. The decades-old law is intended to keep Native children with Native families. Foster parents in three states sued the federal government over adoptions, claiming the law is race-based. Sarah Kostelic is the executive director of the National Indian Child Welfare Association, which is among organizations pledging support to stand up for the law.
In this case, the federal government and the intervening tribes will likely request a motion to stay the decision and to appeal the decision. And at NICWA, we would greatly support that appeal because this is really a momentous ruling for Indian child welfare. It essentially throws out hundreds of years of legal precedent.
Supporters of the law say before ICWA, it was standard practice to put Native children up for adoption with non-Indian families, which disconnected them from their culture and tribal communities. Those in opposition call the recent court decision a major victory, including attorneys for the Goldwater Institute, which is dedicated to fighting ICWA, including in Arizona, California, and Washington. Indigenous Peoples Day events were held across the country Monday as a number of cities moved to honor Indigenous people instead of celebrating the federal Columbus Day holiday. Los Angeles held its first official Indigenous Peoples Day, and in Flagstaff, Arizona, city leaders recognized its first Indigenous Peoples Day while also committing to work together with the Native community to address discrimination. Other cities also celebrated but focused on issues facing Native people. In Alaska, speakers discussed the need for greater protections for women and children who face high rates of abuse. And in Santa Fe, New Mexico, activities were held. This after the city recently abandoned a controversial pageant which highlighted Spanish conquistadors and instead chose to include the recognition of tribes with events through Indigenous Peoples Day. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus.
This is the Middle East Minute Plus, and I am Sophia Arman. Iraq's Prime Minister-designate Adel Abdul Mahdi is taking filling government positions to the digital world, launching a website to allow Iraqis to apply for ministerial positions in his new cabinet. In a statement on his personal Facebook account, the Prime Minister-designate invited those with expertise, specialization, and practical experience to come forward. Mr. Abdul Mahdi has until November 1st to form a government. In other news, Nikki Haley, foe to various people's movements of the Middle East, has resigned as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. President Donald Trump announced today that he has accepted the resignation of U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley, who will be leaving at the end of the year. Haley discussed her resignation with Trump last week when she visited him at the White House, sources say, while Trump said she had told him 6 months ago that she wanted to take some time off. According to the Middle East Monitor, Haley has long been a strong supporter of Israel and regularly slams the UN for its support of Palestinian rights. Withdrawing the U.S. from the UN Human Rights Council in June, Haley accused the body of, quote, chronic bias against Israel, end quote. In late August, she said that the right of return of Palestinian refugees displaced since 1948 is an issue that should be taken off the table. She also vetoed a Kuwaiti-drafted UN Security Council resolution that condemned Israel's use of force against Palestinian civilians, instead introducing a draft resolution that blamed Hamas for the violence and upheld Israel's right to defend itself. The move left the United States isolated, with no other country backing the U.S.'s motion. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint project of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Police arrested a man in northeast Portland early this morning after he tried to evade officers and ran over another man. Initially, an officer attempted to stop the suspect, identified as 27-year-old Donnie Pradith, for a traffic violation. Pradith would not stop, and the officer declined to chase him. Later, the same officer spotted the 1994 Camry Pradith was driving in the Hollywood District near Sandy Boulevard and Cesar Chavez. The officer saw him crash the car into a small green space and flee on foot. In the crash, he had hit an unidentified man who was sleeping in one of the green space bushes. The man was taken to a local hospital for non-life-threatening injuries. After more officers arrived, a local resident spoke to them, telling them that a man had ran into his backyard and was hiding in his shed. Pradith was found in the shed and taken into custody. The Camry was discovered to be stolen, and officers found $800 and 300 Xanax tablets in the vehicle. He was booked into Multnomah County Detention Center on multiple charges.
A man is dead and a woman in jail after a police shooting last Friday near Klamath Falls.
48-year-old Philip Moskios Jr. and 26-year-old Amanda Tammy Lynn Yost were pulled over by the Oregon State Police on Highway 97 near Modoc Point, north of Klamath Falls. Drug-sniffing dogs indicated that there were drugs in the car, whereupon Moskios allegedly attacked one of the troopers and fled on foot. According to the Klamath Falls News, Moskios was contacted soon after by officers with both the Klamath Falls Police and the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency. Shots were fired, and Moskios was fatally wounded. Yost was later arrested after a manhunt involving dogs and helicopters. No further information has been released since Friday. We do not know if Moskios died at the scene, how many shots were fired, which officers fired them, and what exactly prompted them to fire. The timing is also unclear. Though Moskios was shot sometime between the 7:52 a.m. traffic stop and 8 a.m. The names of the involved officers have not been released, and KABU is reaching out to the Klamath County DA for more information. This is Oregon's 32nd police shooting incident this year, and the 17th ending in death, as well as the second involving a federal agency.
Black History 365 celebrates Black achievements and honors moments in Black history for each day of the year.
Black history is happening every day. It's time to start thinking of it outside of a day or a week or a month. We hope to inspire you by enlightening you with those people and events that should be learned from and forever remembered.
Today is October 10th. On this day in 1899, African-American inventor Isaac R. Johnson patented a folding type of bicycle frame. Johnson's frame could be taken apart for convenient storage when not in use. Though Johnson did not invent the bicycle, he is celebrated for his innovative approach to expanding the functionality of this modern method of mobility.
Achievements and events are not confined to the past. Make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365, BAM 365, where you find every day Black history is made.
And now it's time for Labor History in 2 from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1997. That was the day that a group of female employees at the investment firm Smith Barney came to a tentative agreement to settle a sexual harassment lawsuit against the firm. Smith Barney was one of the oldest Wall Street firms with a reputation for respectability. But behind closed doors, the firm more resembled what the Chicago Tribune described as a fraternity house atmosphere. The accounts women told of their treatment at the firm were lewd and disgusting. In the basement of the Garden City, New York office, there was a room called the Boom Boom Room, where female employees were told to entertain clients. Fed up with this treatment, more than 20 women joined together and filed a class action lawsuit. To settle the suit, the firm agreed to invest $15 million in diversity training, along with settlements to each of the harassed women. Sexual harassment of women in the financial industry was not only a problem at Smith Barney. Female brokers in Chicago filed a suit against Merrill Lynch, who agreed to a settlement with the plaintiffs. Smith Barney also did not learn their lesson. Just over a decade later, the firm again settled another sexual harassment suit to the tune of $33 million. This time, according to Forbes magazine, the suit was filed by four female brokers who accused Smith Barney of preventing them from competing fairly for new accounts, promotions and pay, and depriving women of equal training and sales support. Over the course of 15 years, Merrill Lynch paid out almost $500 million in discrimination suits to women and minority brokers. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
KGW has reported that a man in Vancouver, Washington, believes his truck was torched because of Trump bumper stickers. Johnny McKay left his truck outside a bar after having a few drinks and returned Monday morning to find his truck destroyed. McKay said, quote, "It was completely melted, the light bar was on top, was liquefied, it was bad," unquote. McKay is sure that the fire was intentional because the name Trump was spray-painted on the side of the truck. He had two bumper stickers supporting the president on the back of the vehicle. McKay says he did not even vote for President Trump, he just supports him now because he is the president. Regardless, McKay argues it should not matter, saying, quote, "Maybe he wasn't the guy you voted for, or maybe he wasn't who you wanted in office, but now he is," unquote. McKay is hoping cell phone and surveillance video will lead investigators to find the suspect.
A chauffeur says he was attacked by 47-year-old comedian Cat Williams at the Portland International Airport on Friday. The chauffeur is suing the entertainer for $76,000, claiming Williams berated, punched, and set his German Shepherd on him after he refused to let the dog ride in the passenger seat. Williams is being accused of assault, battery, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. The lawsuit was filed Monday in Multnomah County Circuit Court. Williams remains in the Multnomah County Detention Center as of Monday evening on suspicion of fourth-degree assault. The stand-up comedian pleaded not guilty to the allegations. Police say he also has a warrant out in Georgia. Cat Williams had just won an Emmy last month for a guest appearance on the FX TV show Atlanta.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversations. Today's weather will be partially cloudy with a low of 48 degrees. Tomorrow will also be partially cloudy with a high of 68 degrees. Today in history, in 1967, Marxist revolutionary and guerrilla leader Che Guevara was killed by U.S.-backed Bolivian forces. Guevara was a major figure in the Cuban Revolution. His remains were not returned to Cuba until 1997. The quote of the day is from Che Guevara, who said, quote, "The revolution is not an apple that falls when it is ripe. You have to make it fall." After all, it's all in dolly, dolly. But maybe every Scorpio is predisposed to never feel as whole as the first time they felt the most.
Last week, a District of Oregon federal judge heard testimony from multiple stakeholders in the city's settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. The settlement agreement was reached after the DOJ sued the city, finding a, quote, "pattern or practice of using excessive force against people with real or perceived mental illness." Thursday's hearing was focused on a specific provision of the settlement, that the city must have a civilian oversight body in place to monitor the progress of the settlement. The city has been out of compliance with that provision for at least 18 months and only recently established a new civilian board. On Thursday, the city and the DOJ asked the judge to approve an amendment to the settlement, allowing this new group to fill the void. Recording equipment was not allowed in the courtroom, located in the downtown federal building, but KBOO's Sam Bowman was there and has this report.
Almost 2 weeks ago, the Portland City Council appointed 11 members to the new Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, or PCCEP, or PCEP. The new body is tasked with acting as a middleman between the city, the police bureau, and diverse community constituencies to help oversee the implementation of the city's settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. That agreement, approved in 2014 by Oregon District Judge Michael Simon, mandates that such a civilian body exist. However, there hasn't been one since the controversial collapse of the Community Oversight Advisory Board, or COAB, in early 2017. Last Thursday morning, stakeholders met again in Judge Simon's chambers to see if he would give final approval to the PCEP. He did not. While he did grant the new body, quote, "conditional approval," subject to final review next June, he appeared swayed by arguments from community groups and individuals who wanted the judge to wait to see how the PCEP functioned in its role. That's because the PCEP, so far, has not functioned well, or badly, or even at all. As I said at the beginning of this report, its members were seated just at the end of September. That was the essence of an early exchange in the hearing between Judge Simon and the DOJ's representative, Jared Hager. Hager argued that the judge should approve the PCEP for three main reasons, later echoed by the city attorney, Tracy Reeve. One, it looks bad to have conditional approval. Two, it is unfair to volunteers on the PCEP to not have the full support from the judge. And three, the court can still hold status conferences on the settlement agreement and weigh in on how the PCEP is doing then. Judge Simon, in effect, asked Hager, "Didn't you sue these people?" He pointed out that the city has been out of compliance with the settlement ever since the COAB folded, that is, almost 2 years, despite the city's, quote, good faith. He also pushed back on Hager's contention that the PSEP was functioning well, asking Hager point blank when their first public meeting would be held. Hager responded only that they would set a date for it when their training was complete. Simon said, so they aren't functioning, they are still training, to which Hager replied that the training was functioning just great. City Attorney Reeve also tried to push for approval at once, outlining the methodical process the city used to get to where they are today with the PSEP. She stressed that the city does not want a repeat of the COAB debacle. At one point, Judge Simon asked Reeve, referring to the PSEP appointments with gentle sarcasm, quote, is there any connection at all between the city's decision last week and the long-scheduled hearing today? Amid some audience laughter, Reeve said no, it was a coincidence. The community's interests were represented at the attorney's bar by the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition and the Mental Health Alliance, a new coalition made up of Disability Rights Oregon, the Mental Health Alliance of Portland, and Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. The other major player with an attorney at the table was the Portland Police Association, or PPA, which opposed the granting of any friendly status to the Mental Health Alliance. The Reverend Leroy Haynes of the Albina Ministerial Alliance testified that the AMAC did not just want police to undergo, quote, sensitivity training, but wanted to see, quote, deep reform that makes the city a moral leader, unquote. With an eye on the specific business of the day, he also said that as far as approving the PSEP, there is nothing to approve yet because, quote, nothing is functioning well until the actual meetings take place, unquote. That quote points to an undercurrent of all the community side testimony that was presented to Judge Simon on Thursday, that the city is not interested in public input, or at best, defines it differently. Kristen Chambers, attorney for the AMAC, said the PSEP process was far from collaborative, with all steps defined, scheduled, and overseen by the city or city-hired facilitators. Jason Renault, speaking on behalf of the Mental Health Alliance, said that the city has been out of de facto compliance for 3 years, not two, because the COAB was, quote, functionally dead for the better part of 2016. He believes that the failure of the COAB during and prior to its collapse, quote, really seems to have been an intentional mess, end quote. He also stressed his community's own criteria for the settlement's success. Do people with mental illness feel safe calling the police? A number of the individuals who gave public testimony gave their own versions of a no answer to that question. Despite the testimony of the PPA, the city, and the DOJ, by the end of the hearing, it was all but a foregone conclusion that Judge Simon would not be giving full approval to the PSEP, at least not immediately. At one point in the middle of the hearing, the judge sardonically recommended that the attorneys present look in their schedules for openings in early June. Sure enough, he wound up giving conditional approval to the PSEP, with the follow-up hearing scheduled for June 6th next year. Conditional approval means that the PSEP has a measure of authority to proceed with its mission, and next year the judge wants to hear from the sitting members of the new committee to see what they think about how they are doing. Tomorrow, tune in to the KBOO Evening News for a look at the latest from the Citizen Review Committee, which brought its quest to change its standard of review before Judge Simon last week. For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
Now it's time for weekly commentary from Jim Hightower.
Listen, can you hear it? Listen to the eerie sound of silence from the trumpeters and congressional Republicans who so loudly cheered themselves just a year ago for bestowing a $1 trillion tax giveaway on corporate elites. They told us they did it not for the rich, but to help the middle class and poor families. How would enriching the already rich benefit the rest of us? Trickle-down economics 101, said Trump and company, explaining that giving more money to elites would spark, quote, an immediate jump in wage growth, because CEOs would use their bonanza to reward workers for their productivity. The White House even got specific, declaring that average pay would jump as much as $9,000 per person. But here we are in the thick of the 2018 congressional elections and, silence. Not a single lawmaker who voted for this grand ideological promise is mentioning it, much less running ads touting their role in hammering the plan into law. Why so shy? Because their trickle-down giveaway was a crude hoax from the start. CEOs spent the GOP's trillion-dollar boondoggle on lifting their own exorbitant pay. Moneyed elites got the gold mine, working families got the shaft. Far from a $9,000 income boost, the workaday majority of Americans now find that their hourly earnings are lower than a year ago. But who cares? Being a Trumpeteer Republican means never admitting your lies and never apologizing. Steve Mnuchin, a former Wall Street banker who's now the Treasury Secretary, is a perfect example of a blasé, ethically challenged Trump huckster. He recently shrugged off the failure of the bloated tax cut to raise working people's income. Wages are going up on some people, he declared disingenuously. This is Jim Hightower saying, yeah, for multimillionaires like him. Yet he wonders why most Americans despise him and his ilk.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, mobilizing an army of environmental voters.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate change is a high priority for many Americans. But on election days, many of those passionate environmentalists do not vote.
And we've identified 10.1 million who didn't even vote in the 2016 presidential election, an election that was only decided by 77,000 votes. So this is an enormous population of environmentalists just waiting to be energized.
That's Nathaniel Stinnett of the Environmental Voter Project. His organization contacts these unlikely voters, Republican, Democrat, or Independent, with one simple message: get to the polls.
We don't lobby politicians. We don't endorse candidates. We don't even try to persuade people to care more about climate, because these voters are already environmentalists. And now we can just concentrate on tweaking their behavior and getting them to vote.
Stinnett's group is focusing on potential voters in Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Massachusetts, Nevada, and Pennsylvania.
Our goal over the next 2, 3, 4 years in these states is to so change the electorate that no politician can run for anything without paying attention to climate change and the environment.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
A Dutch appeals court has upheld a historic climate change ruling. This comes just one day after climate scientists around the world warn that time is running out to prevent irreversible warming. The appeals court ruled that the severity and scope of the climate crisis requires greenhouse gas reductions of at least 25% by 2020. This is almost double the 17% reduction planned by the Prime Minister Mark Rutte's administration. The ruling gives optimism to similar cases being planned globally in places such as Norway, New Zealand, the UK, and Uganda. The Dutch government will now decide whether to further appeal to the Netherlands Supreme Court or find a way to double the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. Additionally, one of two newly opened coal plants will have to be shut down to comply with the court ruling.
Current Cast is a daily podcast that highlights issues affecting one of our most precious resources, fresh water. On today's episode, there's a rich resource right in America's backyard.
What's so great about the Great Lakes? On this Current Cast. It's been said, if there is magic on this planet, it's contained in water. If so, the Great Lakes are among the most magical places on Earth. They hold 6 quadrillion gallons of fresh water, or 1/5 of the Earth's above-ground supply. That translates to drinking water for 40 million people, habitat for fish and wildlife, and stopover sites for millions of migrating birds. The lakes help keep the economy afloat, too, by supporting agriculture, industry, shipping, fishing, recreation, and tourism. But all that human activity can take a toll on water resources. So many groups throughout the region are working to protect and restore the Great Lakes and to keep the magic alive. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
And now, a commentary from KBOO's Al Khan.
And so last Saturday, a new Supreme Court justice was sworn in. Brett Kavanaugh now sits on the highest court in the land. Once again, the will of the people has been blocked. by scared, angry old white men. These men, when faced with the will of the people, told the people to sit down and shut up. We will do as we please. What are they so scared of? Maybe they are scared of their corporate masters, the owners of this country, the people behind the scenes, the ones who give them money to keep them where they are, the ones who would rather have tax money filtered in to build more warships and aircraft, which go directly into their pockets, rather than into schools and programs for the poorest among us. These are the people that do not want the children of this country to be properly educated. They fear that they may be taught to think rationally, and for now they have won. The youth of this country are now so busy checking how many likes they get on the newest Facebook selfie to even look at what's happening in the world. If we can't wake these young people up, if we can't get them to go and vote, we will lose for a long, long time. And it will be a dark age for this country. But what if the youth vote shows up? I have seen promising things in today's youth. I work with young people here at the station. I have seen the Parkland survivors who spoke up demanding justice. The general election is now less than a month away, and we all need to vote. Remember, there are a whole lot more of us than there are of them. But remember, they cheat. We need to come out in numbers too big to ignore and tell these old men it's time for them to go away. We have grown up, and we'll take it from here. I'm Al Kahn, and I thank you for your attention.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has announced this year's nominees. Among those named for the very first time are British rock bands Def Leppard and Roxy Music, folk singer John Prine, Todd Rundgren, and punk band Devo. Stevie Nicks was also nominated as a solo artist after being inducted in 1998 as a member of Fleetwood Mac. This would make her the first female artist to be inducted for a second time. Other artists nominated multiple times without being inducted are Janet Jackson, Radiohead, LL Cool J, and Rufus with Chaka Khan. Four-time nominees include The Zombies and the MC5. Starting today, you can visit the website rockhall.com to vote for who you would like to see inducted this year. Voting ends on December 9th.
Up next is the Public News Service. On today's episode, evacuations have been ordered as Hurricane Michael gains strength. The opioid epidemic and doctors offer advice for prevention during another bad flu season.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, October 9, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Evacuations ordered as Hurricane Michael gains strength and heads for the Florida Panhandle. Also on the Monday rundown, part two in our series on addiction and crime, the opioid epidemic, and doctors offer advice for prevention during another bad flu season. First, here's our top story. With Hurricane Michael rapidly intensifying and threatening to smash Florida's panhandle with dangerous storm surge, flooding, and winds, USA Today reports Governor Rick Scott did not mince words on Monday night. Making decisions tomorrow might be too late, he said. Described by Scott as both monstrous and massive, Michael could make landfall as a Category 3 hurricane with sustained winds of at least 111 miles per hour, according to current projections. USA Today adds it's forecast to become a major hurricane sometime today and could make landfall Wednesday afternoon or evening, likely between Pensacola in the far western panhandle and Apalachicola directly south of Tallahassee on the coast. The Federal Food and Drug Administration is so concerned about the increased use of e-cigarettes among the nation's youth. Ross Brown reports it's launched a campaign to educate school-aged children about their dangers.
According to Mitch Zeller, director of the FDA's Center for Tobacco Products, the most recent data show that 3 million school-aged children, including more than 600,000 middle school students, have tried vaping. The number of adults who smoke cigarettes has been on the decline for decades, but Zeller says youths may not realize the use of e-cigarettes can be a gateway to harder drugs.
Unlike cigarettes, where kids are way more aware of the risks, a whole bunch of teenagers are walking around thinking, I'm not lighting up tobacco leaves, I'm not inhaling that smoke into my lungs. It's better for me, it's safer for me, it's less risky. We have got to curb this growing epidemic.
The FDA recently issued more than 1,300 warning letters and fines to retailers nationwide who illegally sold Juul and other e-cigarette products to minors, including 21 stores in Albuquerque and 23 in New Mexico overall.
The FDA told five major e-cigarette manufacturers whose products were sold to kids they have 60 days to develop plans that describe how they will address the widespread youth access and use of their products. And today we have part two in Mary Sherman's series of reports on addiction and crime in Ohio. She reports, despite the public awareness of the opioid epidemic, record numbers of Ohioans are dying from drug overdoses.
State data shows unintentional drug overdoses rose nearly 33% from 2016 to 2017, claiming the lives of more than 4,000 people. As Assistant Professor of Health Policy at Ohio University, Dan Skinner explains that like any complex social phenomenon, understanding the opioid crisis is multifaceted.
So there's the role of stigma and thinking that addiction is about other people. And, you know, you have the role of pharmaceutical companies and the profit motive and the whole story about the misrepresentation of risk factors around OxyContin in particular.
Nationally, opioid overdose deaths began their gradual rise before the turn of the century. And in 2010, heroin overdoses started to spike. After 2014, synthetic drug overdoses skyrocketed and now are attributed to twice as many overdose deaths as opioids. The story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
Open government groups say the public should be outraged over a Racine County judge's decision to hold a county alderwoman in contempt of court. Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Freedom Information Council says the judge's decision to seal the open records case is wrong, and his suggestion of a $1,000 fine each day Widener spoke to the public about the case is outrageous.
Now, this isn't the Pentagon Papers here. This is communications between citizens of Racine and their other people. That's what it's about. And this judge has gone full secret in terms of trying to clamp a lid on the public's ability to know what's happening.
Alderman Widener did admit it was serious to defy a judge's order, and she thought the sanctions were fair. The judge is requesting she pay the city's attorney's fee instead of the $15,000 fine. And earlier this year, Iowa beefed up its nutrient reduction strategy. That's a program to improve water quality, and farmers are weighing the costs and social risks of compliance. Katie Rock with the Center for Rural Affairs says water quality remains a contentious issue in Iowa, and a more comprehensive approach that includes conservation practices is needed.
We found that a majority of farmers reported that they didn't feel social pressures to install new conservation practices, but they did say that weather and shifting climate patterns are a big perceived threat to farmers' operations.
Rock says the study polled 52 farmers representing 41 of the state's 90 counties. She notes that respondents identified agricultural consolidation, fluctuating commodity prices, and nutrient and soil loss as other top concerns. And finally, Eric Tegenhoff reports after last year's extremely deadly and severe flu season, health professionals want people to be prepared this year.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 80,000 people died from the flu and 900,000 were hospitalized with symptoms last season in the United States. Medical Director for Preventative Care at Kaiser Permanente, Dr. John Dunn, says people should consider getting a flu shot before cases spike this year.
What I always want to remind people about is the fact that once you get a flu shot, it takes several weeks before your body responds to it in a way that will make you able to fight off the flu.
Experts say people who do get sick after a flu shot likely contracted a cold somewhere else. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsin' and cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 9th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Lucas Campbell, Yasmin Kovanoglu, and Al Kahn. The producer is Yasmin Kovanoglu, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Kyle Kurezi, and coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Show Radio Show. At 9, it's Alternative Radio. Then at 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Stage and Studio. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Yasmin and Sam.
Good night, Kyle. Good night, Sam.
Good night, everybody.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On today's KBOO News In Depth, we have an interview with author Stephen Farnsworth about the way presidents manage, or try to manage, the news. It aired originally on With Good Reason, a Pacifica program broadcast from Charlottesville, Virginia, hosted by Sarah McConnell.
Occupants of the White House, a new way to shape policy and tout reforms. But it also magnifies the president's personal traits, for good or bad. Stephen Farnsworth is professor of political science and international affairs at the University of Mary Washington and the director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies there. His latest book is Presidential Communication and Character: White House News Management from Clinton and Cable to Twitter and Trump. Stephen, in your book, looking at the four presidents we've had since the social media age, starting with Clinton, how was Clinton a fairly significant departure from his predecessors?
Well, for a long period of time, you had your national television nightly news programming, and that was really what you had to do. The Reagan administration, they got up in the morning and they said, how do we get what we want on the evening news at 6:30 or 7, whenever you might watch it? And you didn't always control the story every day. Something might have happened somewhere else in the world that forces you to react to that. But it was really very different than the world that comes even with the rise of cable television later in Reagan's presidency. The first president to really appreciate the importance of what cable, I think, could do for a president was Bill Clinton, who used a lot of the talk shows and a lot of the conversation, sometimes even on late night television, to talk about who he was as a person. And so the conversation became less about policy and more about the person. And this is where Clinton is really the pivotal figure. And then, of course, as technology changes and different kinds of media become more important, you have different communication styles by different presidents. But over the last 20 years, we have seen more change in media environments that presidents have to master than in the 50 years before that.
So after Clinton, we had Bush the younger. What did he master in terms of the media landscape?
You have to remember, Bush becomes president with a lot of people having doubts about whether he even won the election. And so there's this question of legitimacy with Bush that starts even before he does in office. And the challenge for Bush then is how you present yourself as a compelling, powerful leader. Now, what happened, of course, with 9/11 at first was kind of an unsteady response. It was only a couple of days later, I think, where he got his footing, when he stood on top of that fire truck, the wrecked fire truck at Ground Zero, and said, they're going to hear us all soon. And that's the moment he really becomes a president who masters the media. As you go forward through the Bush presidency, the war in Iraq and these issues, you saw a president who increasingly used Fox News, that he found that this was a vehicle that was becoming more and more prominent. It had been a key issue, of course, in the Clinton impeachment right before Bush was elected, but it was a vehicle that gave a Republican president an opportunity to really speak at length. And Fox News distinguished itself from other media outlets as a conservative voice. So if you were a conservative, the thought was you should be watching Fox. So even when things turned sour for the Bush presidency, the mishandled occupation of Iraq, the continuing war in Afghanistan, you add that up, and that's a pretty unsuccessful presidency. But on Fox News, it still didn't look that bad, even at the end.
But would he have tanked if it were not for the economy tanking?
If you look back at those poll numbers for Bush, you really saw the big pivoting moment was Katrina. when you saw a really stumbling response to one of the most horrific natural disasters of the last 30 years in the United States. You then add to that the growing resistance in Iraq during Bush's second term. John Kerry, the 2004 election occurs maybe a year too early for the point of view of a Democratic candidate, because the problems of Iraq are much clearer in November of 2005 than they were in November of 2004. And, you know, Bush got lucky that way in terms of timing. When things went sour, he was already in his second term.
So by the time Barack Obama is elected in 2008, does he become the master of social media?
Well, I think that what you saw with Obama was the idea that you had to take a much different attitude towards being president and being publicly president. With Clinton and with Bush, you saw the idea that they were, for lack of a better way to put it, sort of sun kings of the media, that you had to be in every story. You had to frame every conversation. Every political event should go through the lens of the White House. With Obama, Obama picked his fights. He was a much more diffident president in terms of his approach to the mass media, but he picked his fights very effectively. He used the growing environment of Facebook and YouTube, for example, which becomes a particularly valuable way to reach young people, as a vehicle for getting to them. I mean, one of the true most successful media moments of the Obama presidency was when he went on Between Two Ferns with Zach Galifianakis and exchanged jokes about Zach Galifianakis' movies. And then while he was at it, he said, by the way, the deadline's coming up. Maybe some of you folks want to sign up for the Affordable Care Act so that you have some insurance. It was a genius moment, but it really spoke to Barack Obama getting what the new media could do for him. There's no way George W. Bush would have thought that.
You say there's no way you could dominate the news cycle, but look at Donald Trump. Because he tweets and tweets all day, when he sits down with reporters, there are 16 new stories to cover.
Well, what Donald Trump has done with Twitter has really sort of recreated the vision of the Reagan dominating the news cycle of the 1980s. But that's not so much because of what Donald Trump is doing. It's more because the way that the media choose to cover Donald Trump. If you pick up a newspaper or you watch a television news program anywhere in America, you're going to see stories day after day after day about what Trump said on Twitter the day before or the hour before. I mean, this is a assignment desk, really, for Washington reporters. What's on Twitter from Trump? Remember, Donald Trump's career was sort of as a media figure in New York City, and then he was a television star on reality TV. It shouldn't surprise us that Donald Trump is good at media. He gets it better than people who've been spending time learning about healthcare policy, for example.
When it comes to Donald Trump and the three predecessors, how did they portray their personalities to the American electorate once they were in the White House?
What you had with George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, was somebody who was a really, really savvy person when it came to understanding policy, but not really able to connect with folks. And that was a problem because people felt like they were going through hard times in 1991, 1992. They wanted people to understand that. And when Bill Clinton comes on there and, you know, talks about feeling our pain in many ways, you know, talking about, you know, the difficulties in his childhood financially, you know, he seemed like, quote, an ordinary American in a way that George H.W. Bush could never, ever pull off. Now, Clinton had his elite credentials as well, but those came later in life. And the reality was that was something that we really wanted. By the time the 2000 election comes along, we're thinking maybe a little bit more high moral standard is a more useful approach, that Bill Clinton's libertine ways demonstrated throughout a year conversation about impeachment and all the rest made us think maybe we want something like that. And so when Bill Clinton exudes regular person dynamics, George W. Bush offers up this kind of toughness and a bit more higher personal moral standard that comes from his religious convictions, that comes from his life experiences, but also comes from, you know, the political savvy of knowing what's going to work. I think one of the problems with George W. Bush as a president was that he tended to trust his instincts, and sometimes those were good instincts, sometimes they weren't. And when they weren't, they really, really hurt him. And so that created a sense when 2008 rolls around that maybe it'd be nice to have somebody who is more wonkish, who has a sense of like how policy might work. They might have the opportunity to handle things.
And to fix the economy.
And to fix the economy above all. And then, you know, and then you get Obama, who always seemed more or less up to the job. he might not come up with the best solution. I mean, he stumbled with respect to Syria and whatnot. But overall, you could look at Obama and say, here's a guy who recognizes that being president is tough and is prepared. Now, what Obama doesn't do well is connect with ordinary folk. And so in many ways, he's like George H.W. Bush being followed by Bill Clinton. And so when Donald Trump comes along, who speaks very effectively to the anger and the anxiety about the future that so many people, particularly in rural communities or in industrial towns facing difficult circumstances, when he speaks, they listen. And that was his real genius as a political figure, knowing that the way to defeat the Democrats was to go in a direction where Republicans almost never do, to be this aggressive, vigorous populist speaking to working class concerns in a way that Republicans usually don't.
Had we ever heard a presidential candidate speak so darkly about where we are and where we're headed?
This is one of the reasons why a lot of people thought that Donald Trump was not going to win the election, because this was so different. Every politician, Democrat or Republican, going back decades, none of them really basically were anything at their core other than optimistic. But with Donald Trump, you got the feeling that he really believed that the best days of America might have been in the rearview mirror. And, you know, that's not really something that works in American political culture. One of the beliefs that we have is that tomorrow is going to be better than today, that, you know, the kids are going to have a better opportunity than you did, and that sort of trajectory towards a steady improvement in conditions, well, you know, that's a little harder to sell when farm towns see all the little kids grow up and go to college and not come back, when industrial towns are filled with factories that haven't turned an engine in a year or 10 years. The reality is that so much of what goes on in Washington doesn't relate to the things that matter to ordinary people. And that is a real challenge for politicians, because I think ultimately there's a hole in American politics. The Democratic Party might be more socially liberal, and the Republican Party might be socially conservative, and that works for some. But a lot of voters are in the middle. They are socially conservative and economically liberal, and that's something that neither party has really done well with. But Donald Trump, when he says, look, here's what I'm going to do, I'm going to worry about coal. When's the last time you heard a politician running for national office worry about coal? I mean, he was probably going to win West Virginia anyway. I don't think that coal made the difference. But he was speaking working class in a way that Hillary Clinton didn't, and arguably Hillary Clinton couldn't.
And politically and psychologically, is it more important, do you think, whether a politician like Trump, in this case, fulfills the promise to the little guy that I'm going to make your life better, or better that psychologically they feel like, hey, he makes me feel better because he gets it and he gets me?
Well, that'll be the big question to be answered in 2020. Is channeling resentment enough to get Trump another term? Because when you look at the environment for coal, or you look at the environment for factory towns, even with relatively good economy and relatively low unemployment, you're not really seeing these places bound back. If you're thinking about agriculture, for example, the trade wars with China are poisonous, and that may not make it so easy for you to support Trump next time. And the same thing for folks who are looking at health care. If you're looking about the ways in which Trump behind the scenes has made it difficult for private insurance companies to offer a range of policies in given markets because of shrinking the pool of people who are going to be enrolling in these private insurance companies, you're looking at another environment where, you know, Donald Trump has made it worse for the people who need it the most. And that is a painful reality that will be hard to ignore, that ultimately the question of whether Trump really is an effective tribune for the people needs to be front and center in the Democratic conversation going forward. So it'll be a real challenge, I think, for the Democrats to figure out how to deal with Trump. But when you're thinking about the public, it seems to me that the main concern that a lot of voters are going to have going into 2020 is to have somebody who can do the job. It'll be a lot like moving from W to Obama. You know, somebody who has basically played off his instincts for somebody who has more of a technical understanding of policy. And so my guess is that this would be a significant thing. It's not clear to me how much fun he's having as president. I think that one of the real questions to think about when you think about Trump is whether his heart is really going to be in it.
He has options.
Yeah, you know, if the Democrats take control of the House, the next 2 years are going to be subpoenas, document requests, investigations, and all these things are going to be out there in the public domain in a way that is going to be very, very unfun. The Democrats will probably find a way to release Trump's tax returns, and we'll find out how much or how little he paid when he talked about paying taxes. When you think about the litany of things that Democrats in the majority in the House will start talking about, that'll make the Donald Trump presidency very unfun very fast. And polls do show right now, as we're having this conversation, that the Democrats are more likely to get the House than not.
Well, Stephen Farnsworth, thank you for talking with me, and with good reason.
Thank you.
Stephen Farnsworth is professor of political science and international affairs at the University of Mary Washington. He's also director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies there. His latest book is Presidential Communication and Character, White House News Management from Clinton and Cable to Twitter and Trump. With Good Reason is produced in Charlottesville by Virginia Humanities. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up, we have Preference with Hedda, and that will start very soon.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the comedy show Mental Health at the Mic on Wednesday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Helium Comedy Club in Portland. Mental Health at the Mic is a comedy show to benefit stand-up comedy classes and socialization programs for Portlanders with mental health challenges and experiences. This two-hour comedy event will feature several stand-up comics who will perform jokes about their mental health experiences. Again, that's Mental Health at the Mic on Wednesday, October 10th at 7 p.m. at the Helium Comedy Club, 1510 Southeast 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution.